My name is Howard Polans, and I'm an alcoholic. Bob, thank you for inviting me to participate. When I came into the program and asked, I did my first inventory in 1973. As we'll find out when we get into this, this actually has examples from my personal inventory. There's a lot of examples that are omitted, however. Now, my wife, Pat, has not, I don't think she's ever seen this. And she's kind of the star. So I want to prepare you. I think 3 minutes is enough preparation. Pat and I met in the seventh grade in this little town. I was born in Los Angeles, but I was raised in a little farm community near Wichita. And there's a couple of things I want to tell you. One of them, I'm sure you know, those of you that have heard me talk, it's impossible for me not to talk about anything that I don't tell the story about watching the movie where they were training wild elephants in India. And they started out by chaining the baby elephants or putting a rope around the baby elephant's right front leg and snubbing them up to a tree. And the baby elephant fought the rope and fought the rope and fought the rope until it came to believe that when the rope is tight, it's futile to pull. And so when the elephant was, ever how big elephants get, and helping harvest the forest, at lunch they wanted to hold the elephant right over there, and what they did was drive a stake over there, not a very big stake, drove it deep enough that they could put a rope around the elephant's right front leg and put the other end around that stake. And the elephant would move around, but as soon as the rope got tight, it stopped pulling. Now, the rope didn't hold the elephant. The stake didn't hold the elephant. What held the elephant was the limiting belief that they had imposed on it when it was a baby. 35 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas, where the Bible Belt buckles. I was taught in the Methodist Church. Now, I don't, maybe they didn't teach, but I learned. What I got out of it was, I am separate from God. And that was the baby elephant belief. And you know, the thing about baby elephant beliefs, once you believe something that you haven't believed before, it goes into your memory box, and then it kind of generates a force field that repels any conflicting ideas that you might be trying to adopt. If there's a conflict, it's going to be resisted by this existing belief, and you're going to experience what psychologists call, they pronounce it wrong, I'm the one that gets it right, cognitive dissonance. And that's a feeling, it's a very, you know, it's like low-grade alert. It's restless, irritable, and discontented. That's what cognitive dissonance is. And you resist learning anything new. And it don't make any difference if what you learned first was right. My daughter gave me a t-shirt not very long ago that says, there are only 10 kinds of people. Those who understand decimal numbers and those that don't. Now, she did that for a purpose. Because I learned decimal numbers, and I was a grown man with children, and started to get into computers, and they started binary numbers, and I not only resisted them, I got angry. I mean, really, that pissed me off. I did not want decimal number. I did not want binary number. Could, you know, and there's just a whole bunch of stuff like that that I don't know I'm locked into. I don't know I'm locked into decimal numbers, but I am. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. And I didn't know I was locked into being separate from God, but I was. And I didn't know I was locked into, Howard, your success in life is going to be based on your individual achievement. If it's going to happen for you, you've got to go out and make it happen. And you've got the ability. You just got to apply yourself. Great potential. And I fulfilled my potential. I was potentially an alcoholic. And I fulfilled that potential. That was about the only one I did fulfill. Okay. But as Ralph and as Tom made plain, I'm convinced that the self has to make, you know, I myself have to make my life work. In the second paragraph on the first page, it says, well, this is just, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. As the actor, if my arrangements had only stayed put, they're my arrangements. I know what I want you to do, and I've told you what I want you to do, and you better do it, because if you don't, I'm not going to like you. I'm going to get angry. I'm going to cry. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Now, if you stop and think of it, really assess it. I'm not real sure what I want you to do. It's not clear to me how to tell you that and still get you to try to do what you think I would mean. But I'll tell you this. You've got to change because I don't feel good. That's the bottom line. If I don't feel good, you've got to change. And that just comes natural to me. I'm just good at it. Our hero in AA, one of our many heroes, but one of our greatest heroes, was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And Chuck talked about the ego. And he said the best definition I have of the ego is that it is a conscious feeling of separation from God and from good. Now, if you feel separated from good, you feel bad. And you've got to, people have to do stuff to make me feel good. The reason I don't feel good is because I have this conscious feeling of separation from. That is a real feeling, Chuck said, but it is not reality. For in reality, nothing can exist apart from. If something exists, it has to exist as a part of. And that's not a new deal. That's been going on since the initial creation of the universe. This divine order has been there, I believe, manifesting itself. And I come to AA. And it isn't that that's still not the reality, but my feeling is I'm separate from. And I come to AA and I learn that the self One of the reasons you want to give that up is because it don't work. And you come to believe that there is some kind of a divine order that you can trust. It may not be God in the traditional sense of God. It may not be the religious God. But there is some divine order, some order and harmony that seems to be a part of everything that manifests goodness. Unless you base your sense of goodness on having your way. Now, if you base your sense of goodness on having your way, you're going to feel bad. It's just the way it is. And you don't have the power to change it. So, what is his basic trouble? Is he not a victim of the insane delusion? I added that, but I like it better. On page 37, Bill mentioned insane four times, and on the or some derivative of insane, and then on the next page, 38. They are numbered in sequence. It says such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? And then it says parallel with our other, and we love to think of ourselves, the rest of us being smarter than most, you know. But parallel with that runs the insane idea that if I have one more drink, that will solve my problem. If I just have a drink, and that's true. For a period in my life, I could take a drink and solve my problem. It's just that in the long run, it becomes the problem. Now, though our third step, by the way, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, selfish. And self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Now let's look at this inventory as something that is trying to get to the root of our trouble, where we're centered on the ego. And ego in some language means self. Where we're just centered on the self. Now that, I still have a hard time with all of this, but I had a hard time with self, selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of my problem. I knew better than that. Because when I was a baby elephant, I learned that selfishness and self-centeredness means you don't care about your brothers and sisters. You don't care about your mom and dad. You don't care about your girlfriend. You don't care about your wife. You don't care about your children. You only care about you. Well, I knew better than that. I had always cared very deeply about those two people. So to tell me I'm selfish and self-centered, that's wrong. You know, I can shut my mind to that pretty easy. But when I come to eventually see that what it means in AA, at least for me, it means I have based my happiness and satisfaction on me being able to get every circumstance and event and everybody to conform to what I know is best. And if I can just do that, we will all be happy. Life will be wonderful. You just got to cave a little bit. Now, on page 64, Bill writes, though our third step, decision, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to find and get rid of the things in the self that has been blocking us. Blocking us from what? Blocking us from good. blocking us from God, blocking us from life. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. Self is what defeated us. It was manifested in various ways. Resentment was the number one offender. So the book made it clear that resentments are a manifestation of self. I don't think, just my experience, that I need a fourth column to tell me that my resentment is selfishness, selfish and self-seeking. I was told that going in. Resentments are manifest because I'm selfish and self-seeking. I know that going in. I do not need a fourth column to tell me that. Now, I don't find any fault with the fourth column except to say, if I limit my assessment of my selfishness and self-seeking and my dishonesty only to my resentments, I have way underestimated the depth and breadth of my selfishness and self-seeking. It is not, in my life, limited to resentments. So, the manifestation of self, it's the self I want to get away from. The self-centeredness I want to get away from. And become God-centered. And we are not saints. But we can make progress towards that. And I could make very little progress without having done these inventories and worked the step. When I was about 1 year sober, I went through all of the, Clint Hodges used to say, it takes varying length of period to do an inventory. It takes some people 1 year and 2 months. It takes other people 6 months. No, 1 year and 2 weeks. It takes some people 6 months and 2 weeks. Some people take 3 months and 2 weeks. But what it takes is 2 weeks. All of that other stuff is stuff you have to do to get ready. To make sure you're going to do it right. Because you don't, I had no idea. And I read all of the guides, and of course, Joe and Charlie's guide wasn't out yet. I got sober in 72. I don't think Joe and Charlie's guide hit the streets until 77. And so before that, we were left to drift. Well, we were. And I read this next paragraph. I read this next thing from the book, and I made the conclusions when I was a year sober that this is what it meant. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? I read that. It was to me like a sheet of music. I thought Vince is going to lead a musical next year for Clancy's birthday. And I've been following him around auditioning. And this morning, because I'd like to sing. I'm not good at it, but I'd like to sing. After me rehearsing for him several times yesterday, he came over and said, I'd like to ask you a favor, Howard. Don't sing to me. you talk, but don't sing to me. And I wanted so bad to get up here and sing. So, I was a year sober, and I read that, and what it seemed to me like was a sheet of music. And it says, this is the way you inventory resentment. Now, forgive those people you resent, and I'll tell you how to do it, he said. But once you've forgiven them, put resentments out of your mind. And now look at selfishness and self-seeking, because we can't tell the difference. We lump those together, and we follow the same music as we did in doing the resentment. It's a three-column assessment, I think. It is for me. And if I'm your sponsor, you got to know that. Then you can go do whatever you want. Here, I think we're being told that selfish and self-seeking behavior is the number two offender. Dishonesty is the number three offender. Fear is the number four offender. And selfish and harmful sex is the number five offender, along with, I have come to believe, everything else that we can do to find short-term pleasure that does not address the long-term problem at all. Whether it's drinking, whether it's drugging, whether it's sex, whether it's gambling, whatever it is we do in order to get that short-term pleasure, which is all we ever knew, and which we can still do, but it does not address the long-term problem, which is feeling separate from good. Now, Webster defines resentment as a feeling of bitter hurt or indignation from a sense of being injured or offended. That's exactly what you do when you do not do what I tell you to do. Or, I haven't told you, you know, my dad used to whip me for doing stuff that he said not to me to do. But a lot of times he whipped me bad. I said, I didn't know. He said, by God, you'll know the next time. If I haven't told you what I want you to do, you should know. And you should behave that way. And if you don't, I'm offended. Because I feel bad. And if you just do it right, I'd feel better, I think. It had been helpful to me in doing my inventory, and particularly, not particularly, but with my resentments, by orienting myself to my home, who I was living with, who was in the neighborhood, what town I lived in, who did I know in town, and how did we get along? Well, I worked while I lived in that house. Who did I work for, and who worked for me? By orienting myself to that, and then just kind of looking at how my life went there, I found a lot of resentment. Bob B., in a tape I have of him talking about the fourth step, he said, if you have trouble getting this started, why don't you talk to your boss and say, I'm starting to do this list of character defects, and I can't think of any. Tell your wife, your kids. He said, in a little bit, you'll have a lot. You'll be a long way into this inventory. That is the truth. But by orienting myself to where I live, and then kind of reliving the high spots or the low spots, I can identify my resentment. And then once I have all of those resentments, I can go to my previous home and go through that same thing, clear back to where In 1932, I moved into a with my dad and four kids moved into a two-bedroom house. One of the bedrooms was very small, though. That was my two sisters. My brother and I and dad and mom stayed and had the same bedroom, along with a washing machine and all the tubs between our beds. So it was a compressed area. And I go back to there and go through the things that I resented about that. Then when I get through, at the on page 66, it says, here's the key. Here's the key. Let's look at these resentments from and these people that I resent, and these institutions I resent, and the principles I resent. Let's look at each one of them in an entirely different way. Perhaps these people were spiritually sick. What might their spiritual sickness be when you're in the fourth step? It might be that they're self-centered. It might be that they're basing their sense of well-being on you conforming to what they want. They ain't interested in conforming to what you want. That's what you resent about them. But if I look and see they are perhaps like me, then I can cut them some slack. I could say, geez, my dad was an alcoholic. He died sober at an AA meeting. One year at the Kansas State Convention, when Cliff sent me in to substitute, I went through the archives there. And the Sumner County archives, of all the meetings in Sumner County, there wasn't one of them that didn't mention my dad and how my dad had helped them get started. He and Bill Bringer had started AA in Argonia, Kansas, which was the first Sumner County meeting. And it just went, and I always thought that was that just one of the hundreds of good things that have happened to me because I know Cliff Roach. But that was a tremendous change in my life to see that for 3 years, my dad was sober, and he was helping people get sober. He was helping groups get started. He was carrying the traditions, which had just come out. He got sober in July of 46. And they were published in the long form in April of 46. So I saw my dad was in that history. And it makes, you know, it makes forgiveness. Cut him some slack. I could see that he liked me. And I can cut him some slack. It says we ask God how to show them patience, pity, and kindness. I switched pity to compassion. The dictionary lets me do that. So I give him patience, compassion, tolerance, and kindness. Those things are forgiving. There's no quid pro quo. There's no let's make a deal. They are forgiving. And you want to forgive them because the beating that I got in 1935 is over with every place in the world except in my head. And I still have it in my head when I'm 40 years old. And I don't just have it, I have it as a tall pole in the tent of my life. I don't run into a problem that I don't blame my dad for. That's because I went to therapy before I came to the program. Therapists don't... there was no therapist told me to do that. He could have kept me there forever at $35 an hour when we didn't have nothing. He could have kept me there forever and never convinced me that my dad wasn't my problem. It just, I was simply not open to it. And after I came to AA, I was open to it. Let's look on page 3. My, how time flies. I told that to Pat one time. She said, it don't fly so fast if you're just sitting there listening to you. She said, time drags and drags and drags. I kind of switched the sequence that I had in my first inventory. I didn't have columns. I just kind of, you know, in the next chapter it says, once you've told someone your entire life story. And that's what I settled on as a format. Just succinct things, starting with my dad, and then succinct statements about why I resented my dad. And at this home. And then I went and then list why I resented my mom and my brother, particularly my brother, and my school teachers, and all the way down. I have reversed that in this sample because the book says we go back through our lives. And I'm tired of arguing with the people I sponsor that that means you start at the present. I'm tired of them arguing with me, so I switched it. And say it says go back through our lives. We start now and go backwards. My neighbor. I'm resentful at, from 1995 to the present, I was living in Gilbert, Arizona with my wife. I'm resentful at my neighbor. Has noisy pool parties late at night. I never did that myself. We didn't have a pool. Barking dogs. We have a lawn in Arizona. He has a desert landscape. And he's out there drunk with this spray. And he kills my grass. And his weeds just keep growing up through the rock. But he's wiping out my grass. Now, I can forgive that. Because I did. Didn't even talk to him about it. He saw this big yellow streak in my yard. He had to know. I have a business, and one of the guys in Los Angeles that's associated with my business, not any of my direct partners, is a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And I resented him. Blue Comics, my business is a comedy club, and I resent comics that just get up there and give colorful jokes that aren't funny, but are sprinkled with the F word or many other. I don't like it. I don't like it, and I find every time I think about it, I don't like it. That's a resentment. We're rescinding it. And I got to cut them some slack. You know, I don't have to like them. We fill the place up. The people that are there, my purpose in life today, I think, is to serve my fellow man and God. When my life is working best, I love my life because I'm providing an AA meeting for all non-alcoholics, where people can come in and get a different look on life and laugh about it. What a fine service that is. And I'm working on the other. Part of what I'm working on is to clean it up a little bit. Now, I'm like Chuck C. Now, I'm not much like Chuck C, but that I have made my goal to be of service. And it's making me rich. And it's hard to stay out of the money. Because that is the baby elephant belief. If I just had more money. Howard Hughes, who's one of my heroes, ran less than $900,000 from that the Texas courts evaluated his inheritance at. $800,000+. He ran that into $20 billion. $20 billion. That's when a billion was a lot of money. And he had 20 of them. And I bet you he didn't have 20 happy days in his adult life. So it's not there. We know where it is, but how do we get there? How do we get those things that have been blocking us from him out of the way? Well, I put California down here. From 1991 to 95, I resented California because it was too crowded. We had been living, which counts for why we're living in Gilbert now. But before that, in 1985 to 91, I was living in Chandler, Arizona with my wife and daughter. I had a subordinate that worked for me who, when I would tell him to do something, I'd try to get him to do it, he would reinterpret his part of the contract with the government and say, I can't do that because it's not in my contract and we can't spend money on stuff in the, you know. And if somebody takes that position, you resent it. Human resources, that's a department in our company. They treated me like they thought I was a male chauvinist pig when I wasn't. Et cetera, et cetera. From 1953 to 1985, living in Southern California with my wife, two sons, and a daughter, I resent my wife. Why? She joined Al-Anon and will no longer listen to my reasons. I said, well, would you listen to my reasons? She said, well, if I have to, I will listen, but it's not going to affect my decision. Because I have a reason, and that is, I am not going to do that. But she said, you always have better reasons than I have. I got invited to speak in Fresno, California. Now that's out of town. I don't care if it's a, you know, like I said to Pat, hey, we're going back to Fresno this year. And she said, I'm not going to Fresno. I said, we had such a great time last year. To which she said, I know that, and we did have. But Fresno's only good for one great time. Now, she goes, but you see, I always have my way. I always have better reasons, and I always talk her into it. It's just premature now. I have to some way fatten the pot. You know, I've got to put more into the pot than I have in order to persuade her to go. Now, I don't know this about myself. That's why we do inventories. But in the inventory, one of the things I discovered about myself is it isn't difficult for me to sweeten the pot for Pat because I ain't going to pay off anyway. Well, I'm not. I don't know that about myself, but I found it out. I sweeten the pot, I get her to go, and then it's a new deal we're working on. We don't go back and fulfill any promises. And I don't know that about myself. So, she told her sponsor she didn't want to go to Fresno. Her sponsor said, well, don't go. Oh, she said, Howard, get this. She said, let him do what he wants to, but you do not have to go to Fresno. And she gave Pat a little pep talk, so on when I've got my closer ready to go. And I give her the reason, she says, "You know I love you. And you know we're going to be together forever in love. And if it causes you pain for me not to go to Fresno with you, I want you to know that I love you enough to help you go through that pain." When I was living in and around Wichita, Kansas, I was afraid of my dad all the time. And at work, I was my dad was physically and mentally abusive. Towards the last of our lives together, I think I was just a senior in high school or something, the last time he punched me out. I had a fat lip and all of that, but that was the last. But then he was brutal with his mouth. You know, he just tear me down. And I'm telling you, I'm easy to take down. If you try to lift me up, you'll find that's what's hard to do for Howard. And thank God there's guys here who have lifted me up, and there's always been guys here who would lift me up. Seldom do I run into people that will put me down. And if they try to, I know that they're really trying to lift me up. It's a hell of a deal. I resented my dad. And once I got to look at the forgiveness process, it worked better for my dad than it did for anybody else. I could forgive my dad. I could see he is like me. And I know that I didn't want to be a bad father. I know I did not want to be a bad, but I would lose control. And I knew Dad did. Now, there was at this place in my inventory, particularly my first inventory, I saw my dad was not my problem. That is a tremendous thing to see when you pay the psychologist $45 an hour to get him to convince you that your dad is your problem and he's not working on it. Okay, now we're through with resentments. We have identified all of them that we can think of going back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. It don't make a difference whether you have 3 columns, 4 columns, 14 columns, or no columns at all. The truth is, when Bill Wilson's about 15 years sober, he sees he needs to put forth some improvements in the steps as they were described. At least it says this on page 352 of Pass It On. And it talks about Bill seeing these problems and seeing the need for himself and others to take another look at the things that can help us, because we seem to be unfixable. We don't seem to have the kind of fixes. And so he did this big book. And if you go through, I mean, the 12 and 12. And if you go through step 4 in the 12 and 12, I think he asked 24 questions, something like that. There's 20 questions. That would have been good. No, it would have had to have been 24, because everything had to be divisible by 12 to be spiritual. N-A-A. So it was 24. And people do that as an inventory, and it enriches their lives. People do Hazeltons, and it enriches their lives. People do these things as long as they're thorough and honest. My experience was when I was 5 years sober and the format come out for the fourth column. I couldn't make it work for me. And I knew some of the reasons that I was doing the inventory, and I knew, you see, because when I was a baby elephant, I learned that this is the format. And I'd say to you guys, you got to open your mind to this format. Anyway, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done because we have forgiven them, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Being victims of the insane delusion that our satisfaction and happiness depends on our managing well, we assert ourselves, our self-will, into the lives of others in order to get them to do the right thing. And if they don't do the right thing, I resent that. But how about the countless times that Ralph referred to where she caved in and did what I wanted her to do simply because she didn't want to go through my stuff anymore? She'd just rather cave in, or because I have better reasons than she had. And because she's an Al-Anon that believes if she just does things better, that will solve my problem. How about the countless times she had, well, there was one other time she went to Fresno. But, you know, how about those times? How about the times when I'm the supervisor? There ain't a state in the United States, there isn't, a state in the United States that don't have someplace in its state law a provision that if you work for me and you do not do what I tell you to do within your scope of work, I can terminate you for insubordination. Your very job, your culture imposes your conformance to me if you're working for me. Now, do I need to inventory myself to see if I'm taking advantage of that in some way? Boy, I'm missing a lot if I don't. And one of the great things about doing it that way is each time you have caved in because you had to or because you maybe you wanted to, you just might be a nice guy and say, well, I'll be nice to Howard. I don't, you know, it don't make me any difference. I'll do it. Every time, okay, nearly every time, I could not think of an exception when she caved in that it made me feel good. I felt unworthy. I felt bad. It does not work to have your way. I'll take that back. I'll ask the question, does their conformance give us satisfaction and happiness? You take a look yourself and see if it does. It doesn't for me. On the next page, I have a list of, I was selfish and self-seeking with, in what way, and it affects my, I was living at the present place, my employees, I have a tendency, you know, I'm much better. I want to say that. I've done what Tom was talking about. I apply this stuff in my life. I could never have applied it if I hadn't have gone through this and saw, because I did not know I was that way. Swear. I tell them what to do, and they do it. I had a sign. I had several signs on the wall in my office when I was in engineering, and one of them was, the boss is always right. Rule two. When I'm wrong, rule one applies. That was all. Now, you can put that on there because you can put that up there because you think it's funny, but if you work for me, it's important to know that. And I swear to God, I put the sign up and I did not know that it was true. I thought I was being funny. Nobody else thought I was funny. From 1966 to 1985, living in Culver City, California, where my wife, daughter, and son, my wife, I was selfish and self-seeking with her. In what way? Always insisted on having my way. It affected my position of authority in the family. I had to be the authority in the family. And when she didn't do it, I resented it. I just put that in there to kind of show how a fourth column might look if you put it in a three-column format. It's never been important to me to be right. It's just I want to be helpful. But as Ralph and Tom said, this is the truth for me. It's my experience. This is what I did. And this is my experience with what I did. When she went to Al-Anon, okay, now, I wrote down, always insisted on her having her way. Then I thought, you know, I ought to have put Al-Anon on my resentment list. Because Al-Anon was what gave her the tools to turn against me. But then my mind jumped to this experience. When I was 30 days sober, Kenny Sixbury was my sponsor that day. And he said, is your wife home and could we go home and talk to her? And I said, sure. And we went home and he talked her into going to Al-Anon. She said, I don't need to go to Al-Anon. He's not drinking. Kenny said, how long have you been married to Howard? And she said, 20 years. He said, Pat, give it some thought. That there has to be something wrong with somebody that would stay with him for 20 years. Her next remark was, where is the meeting? Okay, I remembered that when I said I will resent Al-Anon. Because I knew Al-Anon was helping us. But I'm spring-loaded to self. I'm telling you, I am not spring-loaded to God. That's why I'm here. I want to be spring-loaded to divine order and be conscious of that and feel good about it. But I'm spring-loaded to self. So my mind, when Kenny leaves, I said to Pat, I want you to go to Al-Anon because they use our 12 steps. And if you use our 12 steps, it will enrich your life like it does ours. But someone told me that when AA was first getting started, the friends and family members of the recovering alcoholic were so excited about their success that they became intrusive into AA, and Bill asked Lois to start Al-Anon just to keep you the hell out of our meeting. I had not heard that. Nobody had said anything like that. And I didn't know until years later, when I'm doing this inventory, what I had done. And what I had done was say, if you're going to try what I'm trying, I want you to know going in that mine is better. I'm better than you. I am the authority. And what the hell you're going off looking for God for when you got me? I mean, that's what that statement says. She decided to go to another 12-step program. And when she did, I said, I want you to go. If you go to Overeaters Anonymous, they will help you with your overeating like the AA helped me with my drinking. But if there was as many drunk people coming to AA meeting as there are fat people, people going to OA meeting. I probably wouldn't go to AA. I had never been to an OA meeting. I had no idea at all about that. It's just I make it up as I go along. That's the truth. There's a situation here, and I know how to deal with it. You make it up. And I did not know I did that. The point is, if I'm not doing this inventory where I look at just being selfish and self-seeking with no resentment, I don't resent OA, and I don't resent Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. It's helping my life. I know it is. She comes home, and she says, you know, you were right. My God, you know, how much help can it be? So we all have gone around, those of us that used to go around and listen to Chuck. Those of us that have read his book will find, I think, in the book where he uses the phrase, in him we live and move and have our being. That's not in the book. The being isn't in the book, but that's the way he said it. Now, the thing is, I had heard him say it nearly every time he talked, and I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. What does that mean? I didn't know it was biblical. And it don't make sense to me. That's how self-centered I am. And that's how far away I am from God. How my God, my concept of God is still, he ain't here. And, Pat's going to this church. And she wants me to go to church with her to help me, you know. Well, a big-hearted guy I am, I went with her. And her minister that morning said, my text for the day I'm going to take from St. Paul. The verse says, in him we live and move and have our being. No kidding, that's in the Bible, I said to myself. And then he talked about a philosopher named Spinoza who was convinced that God was law and the law was in everything that there is. And Dr. Richelieu explained that and he said, so, if that's true, in him we live and move and have our being. Oh, that's what Chuck meant. And then he talked about God being love. I had heard Chuck say, God is law, God is love. Dr. Richelieu explained how God is love. And God loves us. So if that's true, then in him we live and move and have our being. After the sermon, she knows it's a good sermon. I mean, she's smart. Stubborn, but smart. And she's got this half angelic look on her face. And she said, what did you think of the sermon? Wasn't he great? And I could see what she wants me to do is validate this guy. And it passes through my mind, I could do that. I could say, you know, he clarified something today in his talk that I've been puzzled over from Chuck C. Anybody that thinks I had that much growth ain't been listening. She said, isn't he wonderful? And I said, he gave a good talk. But it took him 45 minutes to make the same point that Chuck C. makes in 5. Chuck C. never made the point with me. I have a chance to be a good person. person, and I can't be a good person. I have to be the authority. Who I have to help me has to be better than who she has helping her. Now, she can think that's not right, but she ain't going to think it because I admit it. And, you know, now, another thing, you know, I would miss this stuff. I would have missed the fact that every time I come home from work, I'd hear her say, "Now, boys, your dad's home. Stop your music." And I always felt bad about that, but not bad enough to say, "Go ahead and pray, Bob Dylan." I don't mind you learning drums, but don't do it in the house, you know? And I look back and, you know, I missed a lot of stuff. I missed a lot of stuff that I guess once, if you lost it, you lost it. So you let it go. But I would have never known that I was that way if I hadn't. I honestly didn't resent them liking their music. I just didn't want to listen to it myself. Pat listens to music, and she may not like it, but she'll say to herself, "The kids would like that. I'm going to buy that record." Who the hell ever heard anything like that? You listen to the record, and let's say it's Johnny Cash, and you like it, you buy it, and you make them listen to it. I remember, this didn't have anything to do with the inventory, except it's a good thing to think about. It's a good thing for me to think about and a good thing for me to tell. Aunt Pat said at dinner, "When we get the dishes done, I want to take you down and buy you this new album, this new record that I heard. You're going to love it." Ann told me the story not too long ago, and she said, "I don't like for you guys to tell me." She's 40-something now, but at the time she was much younger. And she said, "I didn't want you guys to tell me I'd like something, because if I didn't like it, you'd be disappointed. And I didn't want to disappoint you." I hope she never takes a drink. She said, when we got to the place, and I said, "Mom, tell me about this record." And she said, "Oh, it's a couple of kids just out of high school from Whittier. The guy plays the keyboard and arranges the music, and the girl has a beautiful voice. They call themselves the Carpenters. That's their last name." And Ann said, we went in, and Mom said, "Listen, that's the record there." And Ann said, it was Karen singing "Sing a Song." And I've never been the same since. And she never was the same since. She listened to every Carpenter. She knew all about who was in the band. And Ann had mild cerebral palsy when she was an infant. And things weren't that easy for her. And she was doing fine and still is, thank you. She's got a degree. A guy I sponsor and his wife come by the house. And the wife said, "Isn't that Karen Carpenter singing?" And Pat said, "Yes, our daughter is their greatest fan. And our daughter uses their music as a therapy." And I didn't know that until she said it. Because she's in the loop. You know, she's in the loop. And I'm out of the loop a lot. But she said, Ann uses her music for a therapy. And I thought, I'm in the loop. That's right, she does. Now, very close to the end of the story, we got a telephone call a couple weeks later. And the voice on the machine said, "Hi, this is Karen Carpenter." And I heard that Ann Polans was my biggest fan. And I called to say thank you. And you can't guess who erased the damn message. No, did on purpose. You know it wasn't on purpose. It was just thoughtless. I did not. I'm not in the loop there, you know. But it's as if Karen Carpenter knew I was going to do that. And she wrote Ann a little note that says, "Dear Ann, thank you for being my greatest fan. With gratitude, Karen Carpenter." Now, that's the kind of thing I want to think about my wife and about her being a mother and the stuff that she does. And I could never do that until we've done the things we have to do. My God, how good is that? It is like I feel good. Never felt good anything else I ever done, but something's working. In my actual inventory, there were 28 little stories, like the AA, like the Al-Anon meeting, the OA meeting, the minister. Pat went to a thing called LifeSpring, maybe the Est or something. Anyway, there was a bunch of things she was doing to find a better foothold in life, as well as Al-Anon. And each time I'd say, go ahead and do it. But each time, if it called on me to help, the help was not there. And I did. I would have argued that it was, but it wasn't. Referring to our list again, we resolutely look for where we have been dishonest. In the same way as in preparing our resentment inventory, we go back through our lives, orienting ourselves from home to home. Dishonesty includes lying, cheating, stealing, telling the truth in such a way as to deceive the other person. That's lying. When you know... You're running late and you make a left turn on purpose. Pull in the first driveway and come back so when you get there you can say, well, I'm late but I made a wrong turn on Dell Road. Anybody else ever done anything like that? Between 1966 and 1985, living in Culver City, California, with two sons and a daughter. I was dishonest with my employer. I stole some test equipment. My security after that was heavily affected, and I had anxiety over it. And soon after that, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not correct favorable timekeeping errors in my phoned up expense reports. The thing is, they had a new system so that we could take one-day vacations. They never got that system working good. So there were times when I'd take one-day vacation approved, but it wouldn't get subtracted from how many vacation days I had. And you're absolutely right. That's God's will. That is God's will. If they accidentally take two instead of one, we're going to get that corrected. How stupid can they be? My boss told me to do something, and I didn't, and it was kind of one of those things that really is out of the scope of work, and he can't really raise much hell if I don't, but he asked me about it in a couple of weeks, and I said, Tom, I forgot that. He said, well, are you going to do it? And I said, yes, right away. The next week, he said, have you got that done? I said, yes. I had forgotten it again. I had not done it. And I would, he took me in the corner. Now, this is just an example. I have a lifetime full of this stuff where I get in the corner and push comes to shove. And if you push, I lie. Or I tell the truth in such a way as to deceive you. And As soon as I got out of that meeting with Tom, I called one of the guys who worked for me, and I told him, you get that done, you get that done right now. Then later, I went to make amends to my boss, and I told him, oh, he said, well, if you made it happen, that's not a lie. but it was. That's the same guy that let me off the hook when I took the equipment back. He said, I don't know where it's been, but I know it wasn't stolen because I have it. If it had been stolen, I wouldn't have it, would I? He let me off the hook. He let me off the hook. After I told him I was going to AA, he had two paychecks for me. He had two paychecks for me, and I was out of there. And I said, Tom, I'm going to AA, and I'm not going to drink anymore, and I'll be able to find another job. His first remark back was, I hope you do go to AA, and I hope you do stop drinking, and I hope nothing makes you so much as late for work again. Don't call in sick. Come in. I'll tell you if you're sick or not. But the reason that he changed, that he tore up the termination page was because I said, I'm going to AA. He told me that later. He said, hell, you'd never said that before. You see, AA was attractive to him so that I got my job back. That's attraction. That he thinks they can help me if I just go. He don't know nothing about AA. He does not know literally anything about AA except we are attractive. What a deal. That's not in the inventory. I just got excited. I lied to Pat about the car brakes failing when I was drunk and I hit a stop sign. It's a beautiful story, but I'm going on. I did not, yeah, this will come as a big surprise. I did not tell her that I owed the Bank of America and the credit union $2,500, which we had no money coming in to pay. It was just a complete loss. This was in 72. If you ratchet $2,500 up based on inflation, you're $30,000 or so or more. How'd you like to owe that and her not know it? There's pressure there. I didn't tell her I stole the test equipment either. Now, very quickly after coming AA, I got the $2,500, kind of out of the clear blue sky. But was that a happy event? No, because she knew I got the $2,500. And I had stuff to do with it that she didn't know. And she is not happy. So this wasn't a happy event. She helped me take the equipment back. She went to the bank and signed the note. She sat out in the car when I went in and got the equipment and put it in the trunk of the car. I took her home. She'd been in Al-Anon long enough to say, now, is there anything else? There wasn't anything else like that. I always lied to her about my drinking. I was only going to drink a half a pint a day. Then I'd think, well, I don't mean exactly half a pint. I think I'm going to average a half a pint. I think I'll go get tomorrow's this afternoon. Whatever's left of tomorrow's, I'll drink tomorrow. That's all I want. It's gone. And then I get into Wednesdays. And then I take a half a pint that I haven't opened home and break the seal in front of her and drink my one half a pint that day. And pass out before it's through in the living room floor. And she's thinking, hell, he can't even drink a half a pint. When we are finished, we consider our list carefully. In the third step, we have made a commitment to surrender our will and our life to the care of God. Dishonesty has no place in that. It simply doesn't fit. And if that's a real commitment, I don't think it's possible with dishonesty standing between me and that experience. I think it'll always stand there. I need to be as honest as I can be. is the number four offender. Same format. Going through, listing my fears. My fears were the longest list. Maybe selfishness and self-seeking ended up being the longest list, but fear is a tall pole in the tent of my life. Some place in my life I intuitively knew, without knowing it, that I lacked the power to do the things that I've been taught I have to do to have a good life. I know I don't have the power, and I'm just automatically afraid. I'm automatically afraid. So I go back through my life and I list my fears. List all of them. After we have listed all of our fears, the book said we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance is good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. Perhaps there is a better way. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite self. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent... Okay, I'm going to stop a little early. My watch says 30 seconds early. I love you.